From the Sky News Centre at 5, Wayne Rooney won't be leaving Manchester United. Only days after indicating he wanted to exit Old Trafford, he signed a new five-year contract. Speaking on MUTV, manager Sir Alex Ferguson says the striker regrets the events of the past week.
His second thoughts now, and he wants to stay. And he apologised to me this morning and the players. And I think he'll do that with the fans, which is important.
And you can see the whole interview on MUTV. A former Roman Catholic priest has been jailed for 21 years for sexual offences against young boys. James Robinson carried out the abuse at a number of churches across the West Midlands between the 1950s and 80s. Previously, secret files on the death of government weapons inspector Dr. David Kelly suggest he did kill himself. Dr. Kelly was found dead in 2003 after he'd emerged as the source of claims the government sexed up the case for the Iraq War. Dr. Kelly's close friend, Tom Mangold, has always believed it was suicide.
There is not a shred of evidence to suggest anything other than David killed himself. Sadly, but he did. I think it should draw a line under it. I hope the family find closure with it. I have my doubts.
Attempts to free a nuclear-powered submarine which has run aground off the Isle of Skye will get underway at high tide this evening. The Ministry of Defence says no one was injured when HMS Astute got stuck on rocks. She's the Navy's biggest and newest sub, and it's not being treated as a nuclear incident. The inquest of a civilian navigator who fell from a military jet as it flew upside down has recorded an accidental death verdict. Former RAF flyer Mike Harland died in 2007 after his seat slipped from an RAF tornado during a test flight about 5,000 feet above Norfolk. And Sir Norman Wisdom's been laid to rest, but the grand send-off was not quite what the comic legend had expected. His son Nicholas Wisdom says when his dad spoke about funeral arrangements a few years ago, he said, "Just chuck me off the end of the pier." That's the latest. I'm Chloe Culpin.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
It's me, Hilary, with Fiwi Sinting, The Taste of the Caribbean, every Thursday afternoon. We have our Nancy Stories, Chuckles Corner, with lots of good humour. We love our humour in the Caribbean. Features, and we have Nuff Nuff Good Music with Mento, Ska, Rocksteady, Reggae. Yep, Fiwi Sinting. Every Thursday afternoon between 12 and 1 o'clock with me, Hilary.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
We're all in this together.
We are all in this together.
We are all in this together.
And I believe that we are all in this together.
We're all in this together.
When we say we're all in this together, we mean it.
Yeah. Hello and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling. On the week that the Chancellor George Osborne announced £81 billion worth of cuts, which will mean 500,000 public service job losses, I'm joined by the leader of Bristol City Council and Liberal Democrat councillor for Clifton, Barbara Jank. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Bristol City Council is soon to finalise plans to sell off many of the city's green spaces to housing developers. Time is nearly up for you to find out if your local green space is under threat and to have your say. And the Severn Barrage or nuclear power? Mike Birkin from Bristol Friends of the Earth is here. And who runs Britain? We find out that Brussels has a lot more influence than most people realise and ask why they are not more upfront about the power they have. That's in the second hour. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. This weekend, well, you can sum it up, going down. Highs of only 11 degrees Celsius, it's getting pretty cool. A fairly dry weekend, sunnier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 13 Celsius, a mixture of sunny spells and showers. The sunniest days are looking like Monday and Wednesday, the wettest day, Tuesday. And next weekend, it's the 30th and 31st of October, highs of 13 Celsius again, but wet on Saturday, but sunny on Sunday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now. And with me is Council Leader and Lib Dem Councillor for Clifton. That's Barbara Jank. Hi, Barbara, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you very much. Hi, Tony.
Now, first of all, what's your background? What were you doing before you got into politics?
Well, I was a teacher for quite a few years, and I lived in different parts of the country, and I suppose I got interested in politics through really dissatisfaction with the NHS when my children were small. Joined some campaigns on that, and the rest, I think, is probably history.
Okay, so what sort of a teacher were you teaching? Senior school, junior school?
Yes, I was teaching secondary school. I taught languages, modern languages, and also taught economics.
And did you find that the pupils wanted to learn?
Well, some did. I think really that, you know, being a teacher is very rewarding in that you're with young people all the time. So it makes you really challenge your own thinking. And, you know, it's very sort of, I suppose, quite a challenging profession, really.
OK. And what's your thoughts about the media coverage generally of council affairs?
Well, as a politician, I'm not always very impressed with some of the coverage, but generally speaking, I'm very pleased that people take a big interest in it, because in other places I've lived where, you know, we haven't had such an active media, then really it's disappointing, the level of interest. So whilst it's not always as favourable as I would like it to be, it's good really that people do take an interest, and that we have to account for ourselves.
Do you think that the press is covering the sorts of issues that you think are really important in the city, or is some of it sort of slipping under the radar?
Well, I think that most of it is really being covered, and we have quite a high participation rate in Bristol in the council. I mean, colleagues I speak to in the rest of the country are amazed at how many people turn up at our meetings, how much interest there is. And so I suppose that it's the people really that generate the news rather than the council.
But one of the points that comes up on this show quite regularly is the sort of democratic deficit, in that nowadays really it's the cabinet that's making decisions, and they can really overturn decisions even made by the full council. So, I mean, what's the point in voting for a councillor if actually it's the cabinet that's deciding things?
Well, the cabinet is the executive, but although people say the cabinet has a huge amount of power, really we don't, because we have to listen to others. And I don't think any of my colleagues would really be interested in forcing something through that was so much against what people wanted. I think it would be unprecedented for us to overturn a council decision. Generally speaking, we have lots of consultation, lots of dialogue, we have scrutiny, and by the time decisions actually come to the cabinet, they've usually had quite an airing. So my personal view is that things were not as bad as people said in the committee system, but we've got the cabinet now, and I think it's important to get on with the issues rather than spend too much time agonising about what system is best. Let's get on, I think.
Okay, one of the big issues in the city at the moment, of course, is the Ashton Vale Stadium, Bristol City Football Club want. What are your views about that? Because I've read in the local press that at certain points, the councillors have actually felt bullied by the city by Bristol City Football Club.
Well, yes, I mean, I think that was the case. I mean, the difficulty arises because the planning committee is a quasi-judicial body, and I, as the leader, am not in no position to tell the planning committee what to do. It would be illegal if I did so. And so when they evaluated the application for the supermarket, they had the responsibility to take a view, to take a decision. They took that view, whether or not you agree with it. It was a proper process, and it seemed to me that the individuals on the committee had a very rough ride afterwards, and that really is not a good thing for democracy, because basically we have to have the rule of law, and people have to act according to their consciences. And if they're going to be bullied for taking what they think is the right decision by a sort of campaign in the press, or poison pen letters, anonymous phone calls, threats against their family, then really I think that is really not acceptable at all in a modern democracy.
But the football club really can't take responsibilities for the action of their supporters, who are obviously very enthusiastic about a new stadium.
Well, I think that the football club has to make it clear to its supporters that it too respects the rights of people to disagree, if that's what they want to do. Nevertheless, I support the football club, I support the stadium, I want to see it built. But we don't have the power to circumvent due process and to impose our views on others who may take a different view. There was a very strong campaign against the supermarket, and so whatever decision had been taken, somebody would not have been satisfied. And if every time you disagree with a decision, you mount that kind of campaign, then I really think that is a threat to democracy myself.
So why do you support the stadium, though? Because the local people live around that area don't want it. And also many people see it as just a sort of property scam, you know, that the city, Bristol City Football Club, have bought this cheap field, basically, and they want to build they want planning permission to build a massive stadium on it. Surely they should have to pay for, say, some ex-industrial land to do that on.
Well, I think they will be paying. I mean, they will be putting lots of money into it if it were to go ahead. But what people say to me is, here's Bristol, you know, fantastic city, fantastic heritage, all the things that happen here, and yet we haven't got a decent stadium. And whatever you say, you look at places like Cardiff, you look at some of the other cities, they can stage major events in their cities. They can have those facilities for their young people. We could have regional championships. But in Bristol, we haven't got one. And so I feel that as part of what the city has to offer in terms of sport, in terms of its reputation and standing, then we do actually need a stadium. And I hope that if England is going to be successful in getting the World Cup, that Bristol is going to have the chance to host one of the matches. But obviously we have to wait and see what comes out of the Town Village Green process.
Don't you think we should wait until we know if England is going to be hosting these games before we actually build a stadium?
Well, if we do that, I think that we may not have a stadium in place in time. And basically, one of the things about the bid is that Bristol is an absolutely key player, and we are part of England's bid. And really, if we're not going to be having a stadium, we might just as well not bother to do that. So it is a question of local pride. It's a question of how Bristol's seen by the outside world. And if we were to host the World Cup, there would be huge opportunities for people in the city to benefit from that in terms of the amount of cash income coming into the city as a result.
Now, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is with me too, as usual. Martin, now we've had the latest economic forecast this week from your favourite forecasters, these French people, Leap 2020. Can you tell us who they are and what are they saying this week?
Well, I mean, they don't say they bring out a sort of quarterly forecast. They're based in Paris, so it's like the view from Paris, if you like. And basically, they're very pessimistic about the future of the world economy. They say this is the phase of geopolitical dislocation. What they mean by that is the kind of rows that are now developing between the Americans and the Chinese and the Europeans about their currencies and the relative rates of their currencies and so on. So I find them very informative because they're very cynical about what's going on.
But what are they predicting for the next 6 months? I mean, because obviously we're looking in Britain.
Well, basically they're predicting a currency war between major trade. You know, we're moving towards having trading blocks fighting each other. You know, policies. There's a G20 meeting coming up in South Korea, which will be like a gunfight at the OK Corral, really.
So how does a currency war work, and how does it affect the population? How does it affect people?
Well, what seems to be happening is that the Americans, in particular, are determined to force the dollar down by quantitative easing. But what that means is that gives their exports a competitive advantage against everybody else. They're trying to force the Chinese to push their yuan, their currency, up. The Chinese don't want to go. And then, of course, you're then moving, as in the 30s, towards beggar thy neighbour policies, where, you know, it's sauve qui peut, as they say in French, to devil take the hindmost.
But they've got to do this quantitative easing, haven't they? They've got to be printing money, because otherwise their economy is just simply going to go down the tubes.
No, I mean, quantitative easing is a substitute for doing a proper stimulus programme. A proper stimulus programme would be stimulating the real economy and putting money in the hands of ordinary people, building infrastructure. Quantitative easing is actually a way of keeping the banks afloat. But that's not really in my view, a very sensible policy. And it's very provocative. It's very selfish of the Americans to pursue that policy without coordinating it with others. That they're provoking a great deal of anger in the rest of the world by pursuing the policy in the way that they are.
Now, we've had a big week this week with the comprehensive spending review. And let's have a listen now to the reaction of some of the people from Bristol, and particularly students were down there in the city centre at Wednesday lunchtime.
No way, make the bankers pay.
No
risk,
no
cuts, no education cuts.
Everybody saw dispatches on Monday night. Half the Tory cabinet avoids paying tax by hiding the wealth in offshore accounts. If the tax was collected, there's £123 billion in unpaid tax.
Now, Barbara, if I can ask you first about tuition fees, because this is one of the things that many people are pointing at the Liberal Democrats now and saying, hang on a minute, we voted for you because we wanted a reduction, if not getting rid of completely of tuition fees, and now you're in bed with the Conservatives, you're saying they're going up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I mean, you're absolutely right. That was our policy, and I think many people still think that it should be our policy. We are, however, in coalition government, and neither the Conservatives nor ourselves are actually getting the whole of our manifesto within the coalition programme. So there have to be some compromises. I mean, my personal view is, as somebody who benefited from free education system, I would like to see people entitled to that free system. However, the financing of it is difficult, and I like to feel that although this is clearly a U-turn, and it's something that we as a party have not wanted to go along with, the proposal, as I understand it, is more progressive than the one that was in place, in that the thresholds are higher, but also particularly the payback period. You have to be earning over 21,000 before you're actually paying back. And much as I agree, it's hard for young people to start their lives, professional lives, in debt. It has been happening for quite a long time now, and to certainly turn back that tide would be impossible. But my own view is a bit unreconstructed, and I would like to feel that every young person would have the chance to go into higher education, and that we as a nation would value it sufficiently to feel that it should be paid for in the progressive way through taxation. However, I think I might be in a minority with some people at the moment.
Now, so do you think you have the ability to twist the arm of Nick Clegg so he can then go run round the corner to the next office and twist David Cameron's arm and get some movement on this?
Well, I think the fact that you heard Vince Cable, who actually made the statement and is a Liberal Democrat and is somebody who holds hard to his own beliefs on this system, is a clear indication that there is no flexibility on this policy, and it is because of the financial restraints that we're having to do it. So I don't believe there is any possibility of change. Nevertheless, it is going to be something, I think, within our party that's going to cause, you know, a great deal of heartache and beatings of breast, because, you know, people feel very strongly about it.
Martin, do you agree with Barbara there that there just simply isn't enough money, and that's why we have to be paying these larger tuition fees for young people going into education, university?
I think if the Labour Party had won the election, there would probably been a similar beating of breasts about the problem. From my point of view, as an old Labour person, I dispute that we are in the financial hole that we are in. That's a misperception of where we are. And the new Labour leadership, we're also accepting the kind of neoliberal consensus around economic policy.
So you're a definite deficit denier then?
No, I'm not a deficit denier. I think the deficit is a problem. It's a symptom of the economic crisis. It's a symptom of the failure of the private banking system. And what will happen, in my view, is as we go into next year, we are going to have a double dip recession. I think it's pretty much 100%. And when that happens, there will be a U-turn. There will be a U-turn. And then we've got to think about investment rather than cuts. And one of the things we should be investing in is higher education. But there will still have to be hard choices to be made even then.
So on Wednesday, Oxford's elite Bullingdon Club member and Conservative Party Chancellor George Osborne announced the biggest cuts in public spending since the 1930s. So let's have a listen to what he had to say.
are going to ensure, like every solvent household in the country, that what we buy we can afford, that the bills we incur we have the income to meet, and that we do not saddle our children with the interest on the interest on the interest of the debts that we were not prepared ourselves to pay. Tackling this budget deficit is unavoidable. The decisions about how we do it are not. There are choices, and today we make them. Investment in the future rather than the bills of past failure. That is our choice. We have chosen to spend on the country's most important priorities, the healthcare of our people, the education of our young, our nation's security, and the infrastructure that supports our economic growth. We have chosen to cut the waste and reform the welfare system that our country can no longer afford.
Now, Martin, I think you got it fair and square there. What George Osborne is saying is that if we don't make these cuts now, then this is leaving a horrendous legacy for our children in the future.
What I thought was interesting there is he came out with the analogy between a household and a national economy. That is economic illiteracy. The neoliberal philosophy that's been pursued by Conservative and New Labour governments in the last generation has been blown out of the water by what's happened since 2008 inside the banking system. George Osborne there is flying in the face of several generations' knowledge about how economies actually work. And of course, most people out there think the national economy is like a household, but that's actually a fallacy. What you will learn, you used to teach economics, I used to teach economics as well. One of the things you teach economics at A level in particular is that that's a fallacy. So although it sounds plausible, it's just wrong. And a lot of things that have been pushed in the last few years are simply wrong. The Black-Scholes theorem underpinning derivatives, wrong. The efficient market hypothesis, wrong. The private finance initiative, all wrong.
So what is this neoliberal economic policy you keep talking about? What does that mean?
It's basically a return to 19th century ideas about how you run the economy. But in the Second World War, and in the 30s, we learned that that's not the way to run an economy. And in the 1950s, Conservative governments would certainly have tried to spend their way out of this corner rather than cut their way out. Harold Macmillan would be turning in his grave to listen to what George Osborne's saying.
What did you think of the speech and the announcement, Barbara? What were your impressions?
Well,
you go along with George?
Well, I mean, a bit hard, really, feeling that, you're in coalition with the Conservatives, because in the last time we went through, such circumstances, maybe not as bad. I was within the opposition and so on. So, you know, it is a bit of a culture shock for me. Much more attempt to try and be as fair as you reasonably can be. I think that there were attempts to address some of the problems. I do believe some of the Liberal Democrat sort of points that we've managed to get into the budget have been good ones. And
can you tell us what they are?
Yes. I mean, one of the things is that councils are going to be able to keep all their rents from tenants now. We're going to be able to keep the proceeds from the right to buy, and we are going to be able to build our own council houses, which we were not able to do under the previous government. That's one thing. I think also that it's very much a green budget. They've kept in the income streams on energy production, feed-in tariff, for example. I know there's going to be a Green Deal when we're going to have cash incentives for retrofitting. Basically, I think the Green Deal that's coming out is going to allow much more sort of energy conservation, carbon reduction work in private houses, in our buildings, which again is a way of creating more jobs and different skills, for example. Some of the other things I think that have come through have been the attempt to try and make sure that it is the better off that are paying more. And I know that everybody's arguing who's the biggest victim and so on and so forth. But I mean, I would say if it's not the case that the better off are going to pay more, and if it is unduly impacting on poorer communities, then that's something that we have to redress as we go along. We don't know what the impact's going to be, but it does seem to me that there have been really strong attempts to address some of the problems that we've got at the moment. And the shortage of housing is a huge one. Everybody's got huge waiting lists, and we do need to build more houses. So that certainly is a big part.
Well, it's something like a 50 or 60% cut in the amount of money going from what used to be the Housing Corporation into the coffers of social housing builders, you know, people like housing associations, and I imagine now councils too, if they could build their own homes. That amount's been cut by roughly half, hasn't it?
But we are receiving other monies in its stead. I mean, we used to pay a huge amount of our housing revenue account back to central government. And, you know, the issue of the right to buy, there were sort of restraints on what you could do with that money. And now we are going to actually be able to build our own houses. And actually, in the last 13 years, the Labour Party has only constructed 20,000 houses. So we reckon that on this basis, we'll be at least building more than that.
That's a good point, isn't it, Martin? Why has the Labour Party just failed to build council houses during its term in office?
You may well ask. they are responsible for opening the door to this kind of neoliberal approach to the economy.
It's not really fair you saying they, is it? Because you're a member of the Labour Party.
Well, I mean, the problem is without changes in the electoral system, I'm forced to align myself with certain people that I perhaps wouldn't align myself with if the electoral system were different. That's the way the electoral system works, and I'm sure Barbara will understand what I'm saying when I say that. Basically, I think that the macroeconomic policy being pursued by the coalition is wrong and will fail. And there will be a change, of course. It won't lead necessarily to an election. It will be once the economy starts going down the drain like the Irish economy has done, and the deficit starts getting bigger, and we're talking now February, March next year with the local elections looming, I suspect even the Conservatives will suddenly realise that they can find money to save their own skins. They will.
Well, one of the big principles in George Osborne's speech, the Comprehensive Spending Review, was fairness. So let's have a listen to what George had to say about that.
All in this together and all must make a contribution. Fairness means creating a welfare system that helps the vulnerable, supports people into work, and is affordable for the working families who pay for it from their taxes. Fairness also means that across the entire deficit reduction plan, those with the broadest shoulders will bear the greatest burden. Those with the most should pay the most, and that includes our banks.
Now, Barbara, do you think he's being absolutely right in saying that this is a fair budget? Because it seems that most of the Institute of Fiscal Studies, for example, have said actually the biggest burden is going to be falling on the poor.
Well, there have been lots of different claims and counterclaims, and I think what is the clearest thing is that we can't really see what the impact of this is going to be.
Well, there's going to be 500,000 job losses over 4 years.
Yes.
Surely that's putting people who were at least had a reasonable income into that sector of unemployed and poor. It's increasing the numbers, if nothing else.
Well, it depends, doesn't it? I mean, some of the job losses in Whitehall are not necessarily people who will be unable to find another job, for example.
But the big question is, where are these jobs going to come from? Because we already know that unemployment is rising at the moment.
Well, my indications are that jobs are growing in the private sector at the moment.
So do you think the banks are now going to start lending to private companies?
Well, I think the banks do need to lend, but there seems to be a bit of a double bind about it, in that the banks, having been told to capitalise themselves properly, are now putting a huge amount of restraints on who are the people they're going to lend money to. So clearly, had the crisis, they are now trying to be, I suppose, in their words, prudent, but it's not really helping the economy to grow in that sense. And I think the fair element, I mean, if you think that there's going to be another 2 billion, I think, nationwide going into social services and adult care, there's going to be the pupil premium, which is actually going to put money into schools where they have large numbers of children, free school meals, and to improve that entitlement and to give really much more care and attention to children who don't come from backgrounds where they get plenty of support. I think there is, on the face of it, an attempt to be fair, but we will have to see how it works through. And as I have said earlier, we've put our proposals forward in Bristol. We'll be closely monitoring those, and if they are they do look to be hitting at the worst off, then obviously that's something that we will want to do something about.
Don't you think it's a bit of an insult to people's intelligence to say it's fair when we've got a cabinet with 20 millionaires in it that are virtually going to be untouched, at least that they're going to have all the basic things that they need?
Well, I don't want to get into the kind of personal level. I don't know the personal circumstances of members of the cabinet, and I think it's always easy to find things to personalise an argument, but from where I'm coming from, and certainly from the points in our policy, in our manifesto, we believe that some of these things are making things fairer, and we will be keeping a very vigilant eye on this to make sure that those things are actually happening.
Okay, given that it matters whether it's fair or not, Martin, what are your thoughts about the fairness or otherwise of this budget?
Well, I think Barbara's
it's a mini budget.
No,
isn't
I think
it, really?
Barbara's quite right to suggest that if the Conservatives were doing this without the Liberals in coalition, it would have probably been more unfair. So I think it's perfectly reasonable for her to say that what the Liberal Party have been able to do is to make it more, or rather less unfair than it otherwise might have been. But my point is that the macroeconomic philosophy behind this is simply wrong. Alistair Darling didn't understand this either. But what will happen as we go into a double dip is that suddenly people are going to remember the general theory of employment, interest and money, which was published in 1936, written by a great liberal thinker, John Maynard Keynes. George Osborne needs to go and have another good look at that book.
The benefit bill, apparently, is being cut by about $7 billion in this mini-budget. That's roughly the same amount, Barbara, as is handed out in to really what is effectively a handful of city bankers in bonuses.
Well, they are introducing a levy, bankers' levy. And again, the argument that's put is that if we drive the financial interests out of this country, then, you know, we all lose out. I would say we do have to worry about income leaving the country. But in terms of fairness, clearly there needs to be a much better transparency about who's getting what and what the sorts of taxes, level of taxes that they are paying. But the great unwillingness of governments to put taxes up is because they have to be elected, and putting up taxes seems to be a very unpopular thing. I have to say, in the
it
past...
It wasn't in the 1950s.
In the past, when I was a councillor in London, we did actually do surveys and say, we will put your tax up, in return, we will deliver this. And actually, people did support that. But in recent years, you know, putting up taxes is a hard thing to do for politicians. And income tax, in my view, is the most progressive form and the right form of taxation, but it's not a popular thing to do. And you know, we find that when we go to the polls, it's the things that people say. They don't want rises in their taxes, and so we have to listen to that.
One of the problems is that the people who benefit from the very lax tax regime we've got now, compared to what the Conservatives used to run in the 1950s, where the top rate of tax was 92%, is that the banks basically lobby with our we bail them out, and in the US it's even more blatant. We bail them out, and then they use the money to lobby for further tax breaks for themselves. Now this, we've got to break this cycle. And in actual fact, if we were to raise Andy Burnham during the Labour election campaign was talking about land value taxation. And when I was an economic advisor in Eastern Europe, and we were talking about how can we get the money off the new rich in Russia, the answer is property taxes, like the rates used to be, because property can't run away. And we should go and have a look at the different mechanisms of getting the money off. The top 10% in this country have done very well out of Thatcherism and New Labourism. Very well. They started off as millionaires, many of them are now billionaires. There is now a big hole in the national finances. It is a national emergency. All hands on deck. Wealthy classes present checkbooks. The people who must pay are the 1% in this country who own 50% of the wealth. They only used to own 30%. They now own 50%. We want at least 20% of that back. They won't like it. They will fight tooth and nail. But when it's a national emergency, as it was in 1936 or 1945 or even 1956, they are made to pay. Some people are fighting and dying for this country, rightly or wrongly, in Afghanistan. And we've got the head of the Conservative Party fundraising, who doesn't pay a penny of tax in this country, saying that he's upset that the boys haven't got any boots in Afghanistan. At some point, there is going to be a backlash by ordinary people against what's going on.
Barbara, do you think that since we now, the public, own many of these banks that we've bailed out, do you think we should keep be getting a little bit tougher with them about these bonuses?
Well, I think, surely yes, we own them. Yes. I think we should. I think we should be much tougher with them. And I think also the fact of they're not lending is something that needs to be addressed. If they are in public ownership, then, you know, we as the public have a right to expect that our economy will benefit from the fact that they are. They have been nationalised. So I do agree with that. However, I think that politicians who have, you know, really good intentions often fall foul of the way that the international financing system works. And the thing that everybody is really worried about are runs on currencies and mass departures of income from the country, which is something that keeps everybody fairly sensitised to what people in the financial markets are actually doing.
Well, it sounds like they're holding us to ransom.
Yeah, it sounds to me like there's a lot of politicians biting their nails, worried about what the markets are going to do. And then, in fact, what they should be doing is doing what the public want, not what the markets want.
Can I just pick up on something that Barbara said earlier about the banks being given a double bind, which is to lend but also to rebuild their capital base? That is all predicated on the idea that we want to go back to having a privately run banking system. Maybe we don't. Maybe we don't want to go to...
But what's the alternative?
We could have a publicly run system permanently, not just as an emergency.
Well, I don't think the bankers would like that, Martin.
No, they wouldn't, would they? In fact, what you'd do, they need to be put through a bankruptcy procedure, in which would involve sacking all of the existing management and promoting middle managers to run a completely different system based on a completely different philosophy. But we're not going to do that until we've fallen in the water and everybody realises that they're drowning. At that point, they'll be willing to talk about the things that are necessary. At the moment, we're still in denial.
One of the other problems is tax avoidance, as we've been talking about a couple of times. And on Monday this week, Channel 4's Dispatches series, as one of the few political documentaries left, in fact, despite the massive growth in TV channels, Dispatches covered tax avoidance this week. So let's have a listen.
Many of those that helped fund David Cameron's victorious campaign work in the City of London, and many run hedge funds that take high-risk investment strategies. Hedge funds have been blamed for helping to undermine the banks and contributing to our country's financial crisis.
And many of these hedge funds themselves are based in somewhere we were shown on Dispatches called the Cayman Islands. What is this place, Martin?
Well, it's a place in the Caribbean where hedge funds go.
And we also heard before the election all parties talking about clamping down on tax avoidance. But we've also heard in part of that documentary that there's been a bit of a U-turn from the government.
No part of the world should be able to hold the rest of the world to ransom in the post-credit crunch era. No place should have tax haven status in that way.
It was to be the first test of the new government's promise to crack down on offshore tax havens. Just a few weeks after the election, Mr. Bellingham told the Caymans they could borrow their extra cash from the markets. He's forced them to implement austerity measures, but crucially, the threat of direct taxes was lifted.
I'm amazed if officials will have changed their advice. Their advice to me was very clearly that the situation in Cayman is completely unsustainable. I'm amazed if they have changed their advice, and I can only presume, therefore, that the ministers have overturned official advice, which I think is worrying in itself.
Well, that's Labour's former Treasury Minister, Chris Bryant. Maybe you could start on this one, Martin. It seems there's been a bit of a U-turn. Why is it that we're told before the election that these offshore tax havens are going to be cleared up in some way, and at least there's going to be some form of taxation on the people that have got their money there? And now we're told, oh, well, actually, we're just going to leave them alone.
Well, to be honest with you, even if the Labour Party had won the election, I suspect there would have been a very lacklustre response. The financial oligarchy have a massive overweening power, and the main political problem developed societies now face is how are we going to put this genie back in the bottle, which was let out of the bottle by financial deregulation by the Conservatives in the 1980s, and then Labour had 13 years in power and did nothing about it, and then of course we hit the wall, and now our heads have gone through the windscreen, and now we're calling for the ambulance. It's a real problem. They have massive political power, both here and in the United States. Very difficult to rein them in.
Barbara, do you think that the Liberal Democrat Party's got the oomph to take on the political power of the people who have you know, obviously they've got a lot of their wealth abroad and they're not even paying tax in Britain.
I would certainly hope so. I think probably, though, that what is we're talking about is a bit of a long campaign that's going to have to be worked at fairly determinedly. But I don't see anybody being able to suddenly impose the kind of conditions we'd like on these circumstances.
The problem being that that these wealthy people will just simply leave if we try and tax, for example, some of the British
What I've thought about that is that if people want to leave the country to avoid tax, we should simply deprive them of their citizenship. You either pay all of your taxes, which you're supposed to pay in Britain, or you can leave the country and don't pay taxes, but we will deprive you of your citizenship and your children and your grandchildren. If you don't want to be on Team Britain, you don't have to be, but you won't ever be again, ever. We're only interested in having team players.
See, this again, Barbara, is it looks very unfair, doesn't it, that the people who have got the wealth already are able to keep it out of the tax system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly does, and it certainly does look extremely unfair, and I would certainly want to look at ways that we could address this. But it's a little bit like addressing computer crime. The people who are doing this are so much cleverer with the systems than we are that actually just getting to the bottom of some of the things that go on is something for very skilled and clever people to do.
And I suppose that organised crime or else tax avoidance people can probably pay them more than they would get in the public sector. Yeah. Anyway, now, one wonders who thinks these things up. Let's move on to things a bit more local. But proposals are afoot again to institute a US-style system in Bristol with an elected police chief and mayor. But we may only be asked if we want to do this after it comes a fait accompli. Friday Drive Times' Clive Somerville has the details. Clive.
Yeah, well, here's a thought for a Friday evening. Could council leader Barbara Jenk become a Boris Johnson-style mayor for Bristol? When the coalition government came to power, the Tory Lib Dem agreement stated, "We will create elected mayors in the 12 largest English cities, subject to confirmatory referendums and full scrutiny by elected councillors." But it now looks like the mayors will be put in place and the referendum held later, in a kind of shoot first, ask questions later policy. So what would these new mayors do? Well, they would be given powers over some budgets and possibly transport and planning in an attempt to, quote, shift power back to the people. It's worth pointing out, by the way, that these new style mayors should not be confused with the city's Lord Mayor, which is a non-political and ceremonial post to represent the city at official events. Barbara Jenk has said, regarding the proposal for a new mayor, it's not clear what powers these new mayors would be given and how they would work alongside existing councillors. She says that the priority is for Bristol to have good leadership first and foremost, but elected mayors were not necessarily the right answer. So if the new mayoral post was introduced, it would probably be for 4 years. Yet in Bristol, a third of the 70 councillors are re-elected each year. So they each serve a term of office for 4 years themselves. The city already has separate proposals for an elected mayor underway, though the change would not give the leader the same scale of powers that is being proposed by the government. Currently, the leader is elected by full council, but residents are being asked to vote on whether they want to directly elect a mayor to serve a four-year term.
So, Barbara, can you tell us, first of all, what the latest is and then what you think of this proposal?
Yes, well, it sounds to me as though the coalition government has got itself into a bit of a muddle on this one. And my suspicion is that there is a difference of view between key players. About a week ago, I was told that this idea of the leader was going to be made the mayor and then there would be a confirmatory referendum. But I don't think that is now going to happen because, as I understand it, Eric Pickles was put on the spot in Parliament yesterday and he's now said that that arrangement is not actually going to go forward.
That's a bit cheeky, though, isn't it, to say, well, we're going to actually institute this and then afterwards we're going to have a referendum asking people whether they want it?
Well, I think it's absolutely ludicrous. I mean, how on earth you can have an elected mayor and ask people afterwards, you know, whether they agree with it? And worse still, I mean, I don't actually support the elected mayor principle, and I think I and quite a few colleagues would be campaigning against it. So we'd have a real silly situation, wouldn't we, where you're actually campaigning against the position that you yourself have been obliged to hold. I don't think that will work at all, but we will want to have better guidance about what is going to happen.
So why are you so against it?
Well, I think that it places too much emphasis on individuals, myself. I think we have a democratic system. We have leadership in the form of the cabinet. We have councillors who have jobs within that. And we have a collective leadership within the city. I'm the leader. The buck stops with me. I think that that's a better way. When you place all your eggs in one basket on one individual, when something goes wrong, or that individual for some totally quirky reason suddenly becomes particularly unpopular, then what happens to the city? You know, all that we're trying to do to raise the profile, put Bristol in with, you know, European cities and really put Bristol on the map, we then having to fight against this idea because, you know, particular individual, the idiosyncrasies of a particular individual actually reflect on the whole city. So we think it's better to have the system that we've got already, but we would like more powers. We would like to be able to do more, have control over things like transport.
Yeah, I thought you might
in
say
Bristol.
That.
you know, we you know, very confident that we could do a much better job than is done already.
Now, is there anything that we can do to help? Because I think many people in the city are absolutely exasperated with the situation with First Bus, them seeming to be able to put prices up whenever they feel like it, and also reduce services.
Well, we've tried to take quite a strong line with First Bus, but of course it is a monopoly, and we're not in a strong position. But if we had the powers that European cities have, we could be in charge of our own transport. At the moment, we have to get in the queue behind Manchester, Birmingham, Newcastle, Nottingham, and it's all centrally controlled. Whereas with any big spending project, what you really need to be able to do is to plan into the future, to have your business plan, to have your borrowing plan in place. As I mean, I go to France quite a lot, and our twin city in Bordeaux in the last, I would say, 5 years has thought up its tram, it's installed it, it's built it, and the tram is now running. Whereas here, we've been in the queue for our rapid transit, for other transport schemes, which are not going to be as effective as that, for years and years and years. And
but now you've got a hand in government, in the coalition. How long is it going to be until you get what you want?
Well, there's going to be an announcement about capital on Monday. I have to say, I'm not completely hopeful, but we will keep on pursuing this. We've had a lobbying meeting at Parliament with all the South West MPs, with Cardiff and Swindon, for electrification of the Great Western Line. We've also been bidding for high speed as well, and we're bringing a lot of weight now, I think, behind lobbying for Bristol. But clearly, with limited capital finance, we're in a more difficult position. But we are certainly really bringing much more strength to our position, I think, than in past years.
Now, one of the most controversial stories we've covered over the last 6 months or so is the sacking of Avon coroner Paul Forrest for, amongst other things, speaking up about the state of the coroner's service. The office of coroner goes back nearly 1,000 years, and he investigates, or she investigates, all suspicious deaths, including those where the council may have been negligent. Now, Barbara, do you believe the coroner should have freedom of speech, total freedom of speech?
Well, I don't think this is a question of free speech. As I understand it, there have been some, you know, quite serious situations over the last few years, and the coroner is appointed, I think, by the Lord Chancellor. I have to say, others in that position, I think, would have there would have been sanctions, there would have been some way of calling that person to account and doing something about it at a much earlier stage. This has been going on a very long time, and I think Bristol needs to have the new coroner in place, and I very much hope that it will be resolved as quickly as possible.
Now, we have a listen now to former Master of Bristol Law Society and Paul Forrest, the former coroner's lawyer now, Andrew Gregg, from legal firm Gregg Latchams. Now, do you think that the role that the City Council seem to have taken as employers of the coroner's staff could compromise the independence of the coroner?
Yes, I do. I'm in no doubt about that. When you've got interference from a local authority, all right, they're the paymasters, but they have no right to interfere with the function of the coroner or the function of the coroner's staff.
Now, it took something like nearly 18 months for the investigation into the complaints against Paul Forrest for him to be finally sacked by the Lord Chancellor. Why do you think this process took so long?
First of all, it was very complex legal arguments. The whole issue of the independence of the coroner, the constitution, and all the other matters that relate to it resulted in it taking a very, very long time. And I'm afraid it was further complicated by what I regard as personal attacks on the coroner himself. The other problems that the coroner has faced, I mean, having got this wonderful mortuary and the court up and running, and I should say that before that, bodies were stacking up at enormous costs in deep freezes at Southmead Hospital and places like that. But having got it all, we now have, as I say, the best facility, certainly in the southwest, I think in the country. But in so doing, he has offended those in the Bristol City Council that hold the purse strings, and they have made the complaints against him.
Now, Barbara, do you think you've really, as a city council, entered into the spirit of this when actually the coroner is supposed to be totally independent?
Well, the coroner is paid out of the public purse and as such should be accountable. And it seems to me to be entirely unsatisfactory the way this has been handled. And I think if they're not satisfied for the city council to call the coroner to account, then we need another authority that has the power to look into what we believe to have been, you know, poor practice and extreme difficulties of operation. And and I think, you know, that we would very much have accepted that, but the amount of money that this has cost the public is quite phenomenal, and I think that we all in public office have to be accountable. We have to be able to be sure that the public has been well served, and there needs to be some form of authority that exercises that accountability, and I believe it's missing at the moment. It isn't a question of free speech, not at all, but it's a question of whether you believe the person is actually carrying out their office as they should be, and if there is any question of it, there should be a possibility of doing something about it long before the time that this has taken.
Now, Friday Drive Time's Marina Morris has been out and about on the streets of Bristol this week to ask you how you think the Liberal Democrats are getting on in Bristol and up in Westminster as part of the LibCon alliance.
Can the cuts put the country back on its feet, and are the Liberals competent to deliver them?
I personally don't believe that cuts can put the country back on its feet. I believe that spending is possibly necessary to put the country back on its feet, and the cuts that are being made at the moment, I certainly believe they're being made in the wrong areas.
I would prefer to see less spending cuts. Yes, they can. But having the right, both social view plus business view, gives them an ideal, puts them in an ideal position to deliver that.
It could go either way. It can either help or it can hinder. 500,000 people being made unemployed, it's going to put extra strain on the state to support those people. And there's already 2 million unemployed, so it's adding another 500,000 to that, which is going to put pressure on all kinds of people, different communities and support groups.
I don't think they have any say. I think they're just puppets. So, no, not really.
They've really sold out to the Conservatives, haven't they? They haven't kept their promises, and they're just tagging along with the Conservatives. It's not great. No, I think there could have been a better way to do it, probably. We'll see. Too many cuts, too fast, and there's going to be a revolution.
Yes, I think they are, and hopefully it will do.
Yes, I agree with my wife. Yes, I think what we've got now is the best we can hope. Keep our fingers crossed and hope for the best.
If you've got no money, then how can you do how can you sort of keep spending it? You know, and if we're in so much debt, then how can you keep spending? So somewhere you've got to take cuts.
What do you think about the Liberal Party in Westminster and Bristol?
They've had control for a period of time anyway, not just at the local election. The City Council, as it is at the moment, they are still making vast cuts, absolutely vast cuts, and it's affecting staff's wages big time. With regards to the Liberal Democrats in Parliament, I think they are very much umbrellaed by the Conservative Party, and I really don't think that they have any backbone to stand up to the Conservative Party, because they fear the coalition alliance.
In a difficult position at the moment, but hopefully they'll be shown in the future to be delivering.
I don't think they've been very good for Bristol, because they seem to spend too much time point scoring against the other parties rather than actually getting things done. And in Westminster, they're just a waste of space.
I think combined with the Conservatives, they seem to be fine. But this is just opinion, in my opinion, of the average Liberal. Wishy-washy, sit on the fence, and they're never very
decisive.
And that's what I like. I like somebody who says, and gets on with it, never mind.
I didn't vote Liberal in, but I mean, they've been running it for a while. They seem to be doing okay.
Did you vote Liberal? And would you vote Liberal in the future?
No. I'm a very much a Labour person. I believe that if it wasn't for working class people, a lot of the people high up in office wouldn't have jobs in the first place. And I believe that it's the working class people that actually help to keep this country on its feet by taking constant cuts all the time. And unfortunately, I don't agree with that. I certainly think a working man should get a working man's wage and should be able to save a little bit at the end of it and not scrimp and beg to have a quality of life.
I did vote for them, and I wouldn't vote for them again, because I think they've just sold out all their principles, all their supposed principles.
Yes, I voted for them because they were against the war in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I voted Conservative.
Yes, I did, and yes, I would. Because I agree with what they do. They seem to be the best ones for doing what I want, what I expect, and what I need out of government.
Well, Barbara, a bit of a mixed bag there. But let's have a look at some of the more controversial things that were said on the Vox Pop. Tagging along with the Conservatives. Puppets of the Conservatives.
Well, I can appreciate that maybe people do think that because we're the smaller party. But I think if you look at the review that was announced this week, you will see Liberal Democrat policies throughout. If you compare the kind of statements that were made by the Conservatives before the election, the actions taken by previous Conservative governments, I think you will see that there has been a real, you know, influence to the better by the Liberal Democrats on the policies in national government. So I don't think they are tagging along behind the Conservatives. I think they've had an effect. And I think if you listen to the right wing of the Tory party, I think you would get a very different view. They don't feel that their colleagues in Parliament are doing the things that they want to do because of the Liberal Democrats.
What can you say to reassure people that these cuts are going to be absolutely minimised by your group here on the City Council?
Well,
I mean, for us here in Bristol.
Yes, well, we have made our announcements, and basically we have managed vacancies, we have lost jobs on the City Council without redundancies, certainly without compulsory redundancies. The announcements we've made so far look at about 100 jobs to lose that might be redundancies. Some of them might be voluntary, but compared with what was being forecast, I think that we've done quite a good job, worked very hard to try and manage the cuts and trying to give confidence in the city, really, that we're not having a knee-jerk reaction, we're not slashing jobs, and basically we're going to manage the change, we're going to find other ways of doing things with the City Council, and I believe that we are making a good stab at it. It's not easy and it will get harder, but I hope that people will have confidence in that we are managing the finances well in Bristol and that we have delivered some real benefits.
Now, finally, before the news at 6, there's been a lot of controversy over the last month, or couple of months, really, about this selling off of green spaces. And we've had some very good letters, I think, in the Evening Post yesterday about the sell-off. The council seems to want to sell off some public green space to pay for the maintenance of the remainder. You don't need to be a mathematical genius to work out where that will end. No green spaces and no money. May I suggest, says John Michael Rogers, obviously not your Liberal Democrat councillor chap, someone else, a more practical alternative. Why not involve local people in maintenance of their green spaces? Most people would not only be willing but keen to help. Seems that if that seems romantic, look at the very unromantic organisation Network Rail. Many small railway stations, they've handed over gardening and decoration to local people. So isn't this whole process just ill-founded?
Well, I think that getting local people to do these sorts of things is absolutely great. And we've got patches of land all over the city where people are growing vegetables, producing food, working together and really enjoying it. However, we do have more green space and more parks in Bristol than very many other cities. And we want to see that continue. We want to see them well maintained.
Well, so why sell them off then?
Well, we're not selling off the major parks. We're selling off small amounts of green space. I mean, in parts of the city, local people have said to me, this is green desert. We want something done with it. We want something decent. And so that's why we're doing it, so we can invest in what remains and make sure that we keep the high amount of green space that we have in Bristol as a unique city.
Well, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6. Thanks very much to this week's guest, leader of Bristol City Council and Lib Dem councillor for Clifton, Barbara Jenk. After the news, we hear about the green space sell-off plans. Only a week left to go to put in your submission. And who runs Britain? After the news.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody...